Session number 13265, reel number 22.
The Marsden reel 22.
Right. Anyway, he was using this material to bolster up his position, to make it seem that he knew something about something and was in charge of it. And as a result of that, he was put in charge of the oxygen requirements in this respect. I didn't know that, but he's now going to be in charge of what I'm doing out there. Although I don't ever see him, and I'm not aware that he's the one to whom I should communicate. A point about all this is that we were given this training course on oxygen equipment, mobile plant, and it was well understood that some of us would be sent to places where we'd be pretty well on our own in charge of the plant, but there were no arrangements made for us to have any official address in the UK to which we would make our reports or to make requests for equipment or anything else. We were given, you know, it was simply assumed that if we needed anything, we would order it in the normal fashion of ordering spares in the RAF through normal stores procedures. But there was no arrangement for us to report to any kind of central authority to deal with problems of any kind. And I became more and more aware of this in my situation. I don't know if, for instance, the mobile plant, which the chaps who were sent to Russia were sent with officers in charge who were clued upon this kind of thing, but certainly I wasn't. And I discovered from people I met towards the end of the war or after the war that they'd been in North Africa and Italy and felt themselves to be in the same kind of situation. This was one of the deficiencies of the setup. Banks had interviewed us and whatnot. It might not have been a bad idea if we'd had an RAF address connected with him to which we could have sent information as to how the stuff was running, problems and so on. And I ran into them, as you'll see later. Anyway, I began to get rather stroppy about this business of being expected to erect this plant when eventually I discover there's paperwork in New Zealand, in Wellington, about it, and it's being held from me. And I suppose our engineer officer forwarded my objurgations fairly strongly down to Air House in New Zealand, and they must have come to the ears of the RAF pilot officer I mentioned. I can't even remember his name today. And he probably from then on began to take a fairly poor view of me, I guess. I discovered that this later anyway. Anyway, eventually I get the paperwork. Meanwhile, I'd been trying to make sense of some of these disparate pieces of equipment. I recognised the basic part of the plant, the compressors, air compressor, oxygen compressor, air purifiers to purify the air before it went into the oxygen separator, all right, the separator standard, all the separator bottles for getting water out of the air and for getting water out of the oxygen after the oxygen has been compressed, and the silicone gel dryers and so on, that's all standard. But in addition, there was a scrubbing tower. Now, I was aware that the scrubbing tower, which had to be filled with coke, would require a solution of some material to be pumped through it, so that as the air was drawn through it, the liquid being pumped through over the coke would take out carbon dioxide and things of that order. But just exactly how this was to be plumbed and in exactly how it was to be connected to the air compressor, I wasn't entirely clear. actually seen something of this order. I'd only seen pictures ever when I was an apprentice in Collier Engineering. I wasn't too well clued up at all. And I'd been spending time in the station drawing office where there was another RAF type, also a sergeant in charge of the drawing office, and a couple of New Zealanders. And I'd taken over a stool and a drawing board and worked out various schemes by which the pumps and plumbing provided could possibly produce this scrubbing tower. And in addition to that, I'd also been told that I would have to design the building in which this plant would be erected. So I'd been doing that. And because of the height of the scrubbing tower, you couldn't have a simple building with a plain pitch roof. There had to be a kind of bell tower to accommodate that. So, as I say, I'd been spending time doing that, in addition to beginning to train the New Zealanders I'd got as operating crew, and also stripping down the compressors of the two mobiles, as well as the compressors for the stationary plant, to check that the cylinder bores were good, and the valves and everything else, that they hadn't suffered from any rust and whatnot. Well, the mobile plant were okay, but the stationary plant, which had been in packing case a long time, and when we opened that up, I discovered the air compressor had some rusting in the cylinder bores, so I had to deal with that, strip the compressors right out, and I scraped the bores up. I made some internal scrapers by getting some old files from the workshops and grinding them down and forging them into making scrapers, rather like bearing scrapers, and I scraped these cylinder bores out and got a decent finish in them, and reassembled and ran the compressor. Eventually, we were able to run the compressor up. We turned it, and it was obviously pumping all right. We get that dealt with. And as I say, eventually we got the drawings for the stationary plant, and I was able to make a proper layout and finalise the drawing for the building. Well, that couldn't be built in the town. For a start, for an oxygen plant, especially for breathing oxygen, you want it as far away as possible from any large source of electrical power, because electrical power, like transformers, electric motors and things of that order, anywhere where electrical discharges take place, generates ozone. An oxygen separating plant tends to concentrate ozone, and ozone in an oxygen separating plant tends to get, especially in the separator itself, it tends to get a little bit explosive. Ordinary liquid oxygen or ordinary gaseous oxygen is not of itself explosive, except it gets in contact with grease, oil, or any material of that order under any pressure. When the flash point of the oil, because it's in pure oxygen, is reduced enormously, and it will immediately flare and go, and then almost anything burns in the presence of the oxygen. But ozone will explode in oxygen itself, and it had been known for plants to burn up. And in addition to that, of course, anybody in the service in the RAF in his right mind who's running a private show like this does his best to make sure that he's as far away from any service gear as possible, because if you're going to run a private show, the best way to do it is to be private. Because if you're private, you can find all sorts of reasons for not being involved in station duties, fatigues, inspections, anything else, you see. It's, I suppose this is part of the old soldier business. And having defined all this, of course, it was apparent that this stationary plant had to be erected outside the town. Certainly couldn't be erected anywhere near the gasworks or anything of that order for contamination. And, of course, you always lay it on. So Rooker here was chosen, about 5.5 miles out of town, small aerodrome, had been where the Hamilton Flying Club and whatnot had been sited, and was now used for flying in the aircraft which came back from the islands for overhaul at the repair depot. And it was also used for test running the engines which had been overhauled at the engine repair depot. They had two engine test stands built onto lorry chassis, and they would take the engines out of the aircraft at Rooker here, drive them into town, overhaul them, mount them on one of these test chassis, drive them back to Rooker here, run them for 24 hours non-stop with a club on. A club is a kind of propeller shaped like an ugly great chunk of wood, as a brutal kind of fan to load the engine. It's not a normal propeller. It's not intended to produce the thrust particularly, simply to load the engine, and if it's an aero engine, an air-cooled engine, to cool enough blowsion to cool it. And they went out to Rooker here, of course, because of the noise. And so that Rooker here itself was essentially an airframe overhaul place and a reception area for their Hudsons and Venturas coming back from Fiji and the Solomons and the New Hebrides coming back for overhaul. Now, they were flown back usually with slave tanks in the Bombay. And these tanks were of the order of about 9 feet long, or something of that order, 3 feet wide, and maybe a foot deep, which is not a very clever design for a fuel tank carrying a full load of fuel, because it can't easily be supported. They were supported on straps and hooked onto the Bombay, but of course by the time they've flown a couple of thousand miles or more, they tend to get a bit fatigued, and it was quite usual for them to be leaking by the time they got to Rooker here. So it was a standard practice for those slave tanks to be thoroughly overhauled and repaired before they could slave back up to the islands to get the kite back up there. And where I was having the equipment house built for the stationary plant was nearly next door to a workshop hut, standard service wooden hut type of thing, which was being used as a sheet metal workshop and whatnot, and blacksmith shop, where the sergeant blacksmith did the repairs on these tanks. Don't take blacksmith too literally, because that was an RAF trade term, and it covered a whole lot of jobs. Now, a tank which has had petrol in it and is going to be repaired has to be ventilated most thoroughly before it becomes safe to work on. Otherwise, you could be riveting or doing something on it and find out that what you've done is set off a bomb because of the petrol air mixture inside. So there's a standard routine for petrol tanks of all kinds. You blow them through with compressed air for 24, 48 hours. I think it was a minimum of 24 hours. And that's after they've been rinsed out with some suitable flushing agent. And then you blow them through with compressed air before any work can take place on them. And it's assumed after that that they're safe, that all the explosive vapour will have gone. Well, I can remember seeing a particular tank outside that workshop, and the air compressor hose fed into it, chugging away all day and whatnot. On the following day, that tank was taken into the workshop to be welded. And I was working at this time on one of the mobile plant, part of the training that I'm doing to teaching these New Zealand crews to operate. We hadn't been able to do running in the town because of the noise. And when the plant is in operation, the front part of the plant is a Crossley truck carrying the two compressors, and in operation you lower this, the bottom half of the sides are lowered down on chains, so you have three flap doors each side which drop down to make a floor, and then the upper half opens out on stay rods of steel to give a roof, so you've got a kind of extended veranda either side, and you could attach to that canvas, big canvas pieces, turning either side of it into an annex, so you could work in any kind of weather under it. Well, we weren't using the canvas parts, we were simply dropping the sides and working in the open, and I don't know what I was doing, but I had another compressors, and there was this whoomp, and we look across to the workshop, and the roof of the workshop is suddenly becoming a kind of huge red tulip. The roof has peeled back just as though it was soft, and it's peeled back as though you punched a hole through a tin and the tin had peeled back, and there's this big red tulip going upwards, which of course is flame and burning material, and we did no more than grab fire extinguishers and belt across there and discover that the sergeant welder, blacksmith, he'd been standing at the end of one of these tanks, which was laid across two or three benches, and he'd been standing reaching forward to do a weld on it using oxyacetylene equipment when the thing had exploded, and the front end of the tank had travelled, picked him up, hit him in the stomach, picked him up and scooped him up so that his legs had trailed as the half tank, or what was left of the tank at that end, and himself, he'd gone past on his backside across the remainder of the benches in the workshop to end up against the wall at the far end. And he wasn't happy. In fact, he was quite displeased with the whole affair. And we galloped around using the fire extinguishers on everything that was burning that we could find and so on. And one or two of us took the time to nip back and get our greatcoats and get back in again and make sure that we got the fire extinguishers sprayed on us so that we could hand our greatcoats in as on service. We'll get them a little bit charred and whatnot so that we could get new greatcoats. In case you think that's very rotten, well, my greatcoat by this time, this is 1943. I've had it 4 years. I'm growing out of it because I've put a little bit of size on since 1939, and it's had it's already had 40 39 40 40 41 42, it's already had 3 winters of service on the flight line and so on. There are grease stains on it and oil stains, and it's no elegant thing at all, but unless you have something drastic happen to it, there's no way you'll get it changed either. So you make sure that something drastic happens if you get the opportunity, and here was a glorious opportunity. So, you know, out of the strong cometh forth sweetness. So I got that changed for a New Zealand greatcoat, which was a whole different kettle of fish, you know, much better material and everything else. Shortly after this, we've got the stationary plant erected, and I've taught the New Zealanders one or two things. For instance, when the compressors and so on were delivered, the truck on which they were delivered wouldn't go nearer to the our plant house than about 30 yards, because it had been built and it was soft grassland there, and we hadn't yet got a hard roadway up to the main doors. I'd had double doors built so you could get a truck up there for loading and unloading the storage bottles, because they were the RAF storage bottles for oxygen are quite large. They're 7 or 8 feet long. if I recall, £18,000. Has it? Not 18,000. £3,600 pressure bottles, quite heavy, and so you need to be able to truck them up as near as you can. And in fact, I'd made an overhead gantry arrangement with a pulley block on rollers. I'd got one of those made in the workshops and rigged that up so that we could handle these bottles in slings, block and tackle, and so on, rather than getting four blokes to lift them. Two blokes can lift them with a hernia, but four blokes can lift them without. So I'd rigged this up. But as yet, that roadway hadn't been built, so it was, there was no help for us. So I persuaded the Kiwis, since we couldn't get the use of the Coles crane to lift this gear off, and so I got some timbers to act as skids, and using levers, crowbars and whatnot, we lifted these heavy boxes corner by corner until we got these skids under them. And then I got, to start with, I couldn't get a block and tackle. I hadn't got a block and tackle yet. So I belted stakes into the ground, and we made Spanish windlass to shift these things. We couldn't push them ourselves. I think the air compressor in its packing case and so on would be of the order of 2.5 ton, because there was an air compressor and a large electric motor, maybe 3 tons. It's quite a chunk to shift. You could just about shift it an inch at a time with crowbar, with about 6 of you at it, which is a bit painful. So, as I say, belted a hefty stake into the ground and a loop of rope and a chunk of 4 between it, Spanish windlass, wind the rope up until the rope, and then get it started with a crowbar, and you can inch it along that way. One of the sergeants in workshops saw us sprottling like that and took pity on us, and unhooked one of a block and tackle from somewhere, and after that we were able to set a block and tackle up in the same way and haul this gear across the rough ground. Worked quite well. Then we had to scrounge up a brazier so that we could make the soldered joints necessary for the high pressure connections. We had to test up to 5,000 pounds square inch, you see, so that all our joints, our air and gas joints, had to be pretty good. And that involved a good deal of tinning and soldering of flanges onto the heavy gauge pipes we were using, and of course it also involved the air pipes on the plant. The compressed air pipes were about 13/16. They were 13/16 OD and nearly 3/8 bore, which gave you just over a 3/16 wall thickness. Well, that's not easy to bend cold, make a nice bend, and to make sure that you're doing a bend without inducing any fatigue and so on. So I did all those using hot bends, which of course is a way you need a brazier again. And I don't think that any of the New Zealanders I had done anything of that kind of work. One of them had been a motor mechanic, and I don't know, one or two had nearly gone there straight from school, you see, and so on. So we got all that done. I got the plant assembled, and it was Friday afternoon, I think. Well, that would have meant, of course, that the orderly room on Rooker here would be shut down for the weekend, because New Zealand was very almost peacetime in operation at this time. And I decided that we'd come in the following morning at about 7 o'clock and get straight on with beginning a production run on the stationary plant to test it out, check it out, and see that everything was okay. We'd tested it out under air pressure, everything was fine. And so, we'd loaded up all the caustic soda purifiers and everything else. Everything was ready to go, we reckoned. 4:05, Friday afternoon. Station knocked off at 4:00, pretty well. And we were just shutting down 8-6, the mobile plant 8-6. 9-8, which was the other mobile plant, we hadn't run. Not to produce oxygen. I'd run it on air, but we hadn't run it seriously. All the training runs I'd done and the production run I'd done had been done on 8-6. 4:05, closing down 8-6, and next morning ready to come in and open up and run the stationary plant. An IRC runs across from the engineer officer's office with a signal. Sergeant Marsden, been told to come across and give you this. It's urgent. And it was a signal from the UK. Check all oxygen-producing plant for contamination, grease, presence of grease. And, of course, you know what grease and oxygen means. And my stomach went, yuck! I felt sick. I felt really sick. I thought, oh, for goodness sake, But 8-6 is okay, we've run it. So I said to the bods, well, okay then. I said, strip down all the openings anywhere, all the joints on the oxygen set in 9-8, and we'll go indoors and do the same here. So we divided up, and I think Corporal McCauley went across onto 9-8, and I went inside, and we dropped off all the bottom ends of the caustic soda bottles. Each caustic soda purifying bottle has a drain cock at the bottom, so after at regular intervals, every 20 minutes or so during a production run, you crack every one of those drain cocks open, crack it open, let it blow, and then shut it again to blow off all the water which gathers there, or the liquid which gathers there. But you can drop those off, and the same for the ordinary contact ring dryers and the silica gel dryers, and drop them out and check out. Well, we opened up the ones on the stationary plant, and there were handfuls of oily sawdust came out. And Tom McCauley opened up the same things on plant number 98, and the same again there. And we felt sick. Because if that signal had arrived a few minutes later, it wouldn't have got out from Hamilton to the engineer's office at Rooker here, and which would have been shut, and we'd have gone in the following morning, and we'd have been dead, or we'd have been carbonese in big lumps. If they hadn't known what it was about, somebody might have done the same thing in 98 and bought it there too. For sheer chance, 8-6 was clear. It hadn't been done. We opened it up to make sure, but